McKinnon. With me this afternoon, Co-Chairman Hoffman, Vice Chairman Bishop, Senator Stevens, Senator Olson, Senator Von Imhoff, and joining us online is Senator Michicki. Senator Michicki, can you hear us?
I can. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. In the room, I have Senator Giesel and Representative Klayman and Representative Birch. And the other offices are represented through their staff. Former Senator Reed. Welcome. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. With that, I would ask committee members to rise, and those in the audience, if you'd like to, for a moment of silence in respect to the city of New York and those who have lost their lives by an act of terrorism in our country. Moment of silence, please. Thank you. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin today's business? Seeing and hearing none on today's agenda is the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation and CEO Angela Rodell. I'd like to invite her to the microphone. Ms. Rodell, if you'd identify yourself for the record, we do have a PowerPoint that is online and available for those who are following off-net. It's labeled Alaska Permanent Fund, Senate Finance Committee, November 2017. Ms. Rodell, as we move through the pages, if when we turn a page, you could identify the page number so those that are following off net can be on the same page that we're referencing. Welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer to the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Thank you for inviting me to come before you today. What I thought I would do with this presentation is take a step back and talk about the fund and how the fund works. I've noticed as I've had various conversations that there's a lot of confusion about the fund, about how the fund works. And the question I probably get asked most is, so how do you really invest? And that can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So hopefully this presentation today will give you a sense of what it is we have to invest, how we invest it, and then what the outcomes are, i.e. what the performance is of those investments. So turning to the very first slide, this is the language of the Constitution, the constitutional amendment that was approved by the voters in 1976. I always start with the constitutional language because it's more about what's not in the constitutional language than what is in the constitutional language. You'll note that the constitutional language is quite simple. It's that at least 25% of all mineral lease rentals, royalties, sale proceeds, mineral revenue sharing payments, and bonuses received by the state of Alaska shall be deposited, the principal of which shall be used only to those income-producing investments designated by law as eligible for permanent fund investments. The income from the permanent fund shall be deposited into the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. There is no mention of anything, including the types of investments, nor how that investment income that shall be used in the Constitution. So moving on to how the fund works, and I'm now on slide number 4, is that the assets under management by the Permanent Fund Corporation is made up of the principal, sometimes you will hear this referred to as the corpus, and the earnings reserve account. The principal was established, as noted on the previous slide, by the Alaska Constitution. And its contributions are those royalties that are constitutionally mandated. It's also any appropriations over and above from time to time. Additional royalties in excess of 25% have been appropriated to the principal account of the permanent fund. It also includes the inflation-proofing deposits that have been made over the years. And then there have been at times special appropriations when the legislature and the administration have felt incumbent to deposit additional monies. They've had extra monies and to put them into the principal of the fund. state statute, and it is available for appropriation with a simple majority. The earnings reserve account is funded by its net investment earnings. These include lease payments, stock dividends, bond interest, private dividends, and net realized gains. Both of these all of these contributions in these two accounts then constitute the investment of the fund. Moving on to slide five, Ms. Fordella, could you pause and go back?
Sure.
On the earnings reserve account, is that invested then in the same manner as far as asset allocation as the corpus of the fund, or is it managed differently? It is managed exactly as if it were one fund, so it has the same exact asset allocation as the principal of the fund. Thank you. And that's a good segue into slide five. So the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation is responsible for the investment and management of the fund. We have one target asset allocation. It is comprised of stocks, bonds, real estate, and what we call alternatives or private market investments. And a pro rata share of each investment is bought by those contributions from the principal and those contributions from the earnings reserve account. Today, that pro rata split is about 78-22. So each investment, 78% of each investment is bought by the principal contributions, and 22% of each investment is bought by the earnings reserve account. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Angela, Ms. Rodell, the methodology for the percentage split.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, it is basically based on how much is currently sitting in the principal versus how much is sitting in the earnings reserve account. So if the earnings reserve account went down to zero, for example, its share, its ownership of the investments would go away, and they would be owned 100% by the principal.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Rodell, could you explain why, I know that you referenced the statute, on why there is a separation? And I guess that meaning they're invested the same, they're considered the same in one, yet we have distinct pots. Can you talk about why? Absolutely, through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff. We are not allowed to spend the principal. So all the money that comes in to the principal of the fund must be held in perpetuity for the benefit of all future generations of Alaskans. So if we had this as a combined pot, it would be very difficult to ascertain that which belonged to the principal corpus and that which belonged to that which is available. So if you think about it, and let's make it very simple, we buy a share of GE stock. And if it was all one and that cost basis was a dollar, and actually this is, I'm going to go to slide six because this sort of speaks to that. If the cost basis of that GE stock were a dollar and this were all one fund rather than the two separate accounts, it'd be very difficult as dividends to come in. So as dividends come in today, that dividend is owned by the earnings reserve account because that is income that is available for appropriation. So you could take that dividend and spend it, or you can leave it in the earnings reserve account and invest it in more GE stock. And so as you can imagine with all the investments, if it were one fund, trying to untangle the ownership without having the two separate accounts could get quite complex quite easily because as this then grows in value, dividends get reinvested in the same stock, it continues to grow. The accounting of the creation of two accounts allows that to, from an accounting operational standpoint, keep it cleaner and be very clear as to what's to be held permanently, which is just those contributions of royalty and inflation proofing, and what is available for appropriation. Senator Van Inland.
Thank you. So you don't have to answer this now, because I would imagine as we get more into the deeper part of the presentation, but when we start talking about a percent of market value or POMV, or going back to what the Board of Trustees recommended, I believe, in 2003 or 2004, to collapse the two distinct accounting into one to be more of a traditional endowment foundation model, how that could affect the how the recommendation of the trustees a decade ago, 14 years ago, how that might affect the tracking of the principal, or what mechanism that might require to change potentially our constitution, among other things. And then, so you don't have to answer that now, but just keep that, we're going to put it kind of aside, because the concept we should weave in later, as well as when the POMB comes in, how that's going to matter. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Doe, would you help me understand the last sentence of that Article 15? Make sure I understand what that really is saying. It says that income from parental funds should be deposited in the general fund, and how does that deal with the earnings reserve? Am I misunderstanding that?
Can you replace Shelley Hughes?
Hi, Ms. Rodeau. We're moving back to slide two for those following at home. Ms. Rodeau.
Okay.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens. There's a lot of history around the constitutional language. There was a Supreme Court case that occurred over the summer speaking to that very thing, and it was viewed, is my understanding, and obviously I would defer to Department of Law to more fully explain sort of the court's rationale, but that unless otherwise provided by law, allowed or gave permission to the legislature to create the earnings reserve account as a receptacle rather than directing all of the income automatically into the general fund. Early on, when the fund was first created, there was no earnings reserve account. That came later, and so the income was just put into the general fund for a short period of time, but that's my understanding. Thank you, Ms. Rodeau. Please continue. Thank you, Madam Chair. And moving to slide six, this is sort of getting to the point that when we were talking about how each investment is owned. So the principal has its cost basis for it for the investment, and the earnings reserve account has its cost basis. So if it's that $1 of GE stock, the principal is going to pay 78 cents for it, and the earnings reserve account is going to contribute 22 cents for it. As that stock increases in value, we are required under general accounting principles to mark it at its unrealized fair value. That unrealized gain stays with the principal so long as it's not cashed in. The unrealized portion associated with the 22 cents in the earnings reserve account gets booked to the earnings reserve account. When we sell that investment, that the cost basis out of the corpus goes back into the corpus. Any gain from that sale of that asset goes into the earnings reserve account, along with all of the gains that the earnings reserve account investment earned as well. The principal is then used to reinvest into new investments. The earnings reserve account either pays dividends or there's a draw, money is moved over to the Department of Revenue for administration, or it's reinvested into new investments. Questions from committee members? Sordell, my only thought is that that's quite the exercise in accounting to keep track of all of the dollars. And as I recall, there may be a bill in front of Senate Finance, or maybe that was in the last session, trying to make some changes to that. Am I recalling? If I'm not recalling incorrectly, please just put it on the record.
I think when in various versions of the POMV bills that have been happening over the last few years, this idea of statutory net income, this calculation has been looked at deeply to determine how, when, and what should be included in it, because this is not an accounting, generally accepted accounting principle. This is a statutory principle to get back to compliance with the constitutional language. And that is takes us to slide 7, which is statutory net income is defined in Alaska statutes 3713.140.
Madam Chair.
Is that Senator Machicki?
It is, Madam Chair. I just have a question on page 6.
Certainly, Senator Machicki.
Thank you. Ms. Riddell, I mean, I think the answer is pretty clear, but you talked about net realized gains moving into the ERA, right? The cost basis is returned to the principal. How are losses handled? Is a loss forever? And if you had, just for an example, if you had A shares and B shares, and even though it may be of a similar equity, and one was a loss, one was a gain, is the loss to principal a loss forever? They can't be averaged because the equity that gain, had a realized gain would move into the ARA. Am I understanding that correctly?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I'm going to yes and no. So let me walk you through how we had done it in the past and how we're going to do it going forward. In the past, the cost basis was returned to the principal account was made whole. Net losses, net gains were put together, and if there was an overall net gain, that was additive to the earnings reserve account. If there was an overall net loss, it was deducted from the earnings reserve account. And all of that would happen within the course of the year, and probably the place where the 1 year where you saw the net loss hit the earnings reserve because was in 2000 and was after the crisis in 2007-2008. And in the past, the corporation has, or the fund has been fortunate in that net gains over the course of the year have over the 35 years, roughly, you know, 99% of the time offset net losses that were occurring within that same year. I think that the discussion that happened with the Supreme Court case on the need for appropriation for use of the earnings reserve account has made us pause as to whether or not we would need an appropriation to make the principal whole as we used to do that. And so we will be revisiting that with Department of Law about what that means in terms of if we had a year like 2008, which would have clearly caused a loss to occur within the corpus and the principal of the fund, whether or not we could have moved, we could move earnings reserve account to make that whole in the future without
it. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. That was the basis of my question. So that was an excellent answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. And I was actually on House Finance, I believe, during that crash, and there was a consternation. I know, Ms. Riddell, we've talked about it before, that we almost were unable to pay a dividend based on interpretation of a loss and should we go forward in a loss year. We lined that up legally and tried and happily, we didn't have to go there because at the end, some returns came in that put us up and over and into the positive.
Right.
Senator Machicki, because you're online, I have opened my cell phone, which I don't typically do during a committee meeting, but if you have a question, if you don't feel like you can interrupt, if you text, I see that you did text a question. So if you want to do that, I'm happy to recognize you, or that that text can go on to Ms. Kramer also, and she can notify me that you have a question that's holding online.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. Thank you. Ms. Rodeo, please continue.
So on slide 7, wanted to walk through statutory net income. So pursuant to state law, the permanent fund, we calculate and report out the net realized gains. So this could be a net realized loss, as we just discussed. Those net realized gains and investment are funds within the earnings reserve account that need a simple majority for appropriation. These are accumulated throughout the year. They can have no relationship to what the fund earns in terms of investment value over the year. And the reason for that is because, remember, this is what you're realizing over the course of the year. So this is the rental income you're getting off of your real estate. This is bond interest income you're getting. And not only that, but when we have a market like we've had since November of 2016, we are constantly having to shrink our public equity asset allocation because, as you might imagine, with the run-up in the market, it gets over its target asset allocation very quickly, so it needs to get trimmed back. So we're selling positions. Those positions then get redeployed in the other asset classes. But that is a realized gain on value that then goes to statutory net income. We are on pace and forecasting statutory net income for fiscal year 2018 to be $4.4 billion. Moving on to slide 8. So this just gives you a sense of that 78-22% breakout, and you can see how over the last 4 fiscal years and for the first quarter of fiscal year 18, the funds, the assets under management have continued to grow, and the earnings reserve account in particular has grown, whereas you see that the principal is not growing nearly as fast, and that's what I refer to as some in the industry will refer to it as churn. You know, you're turning positions, you're turning assets or investments over quickly because of the growth in value that's happening. And that accounts for the substantial growth in the earnings reserve account. Mr. Adele, is there a, in your asset allocation, is there a percentage of cash that you hold? There is. So our target asset allocation includes a 2% for cash. And we hold for our investment activity, we hold on any given day roughly $1 billion in cash for capital calls and investments and settlements and operations, things like that. That is what we've determined as the minimum amount that we need. Turned out, is that 2% then plus the billion? Is that? I want to make sure I heard you correctly because I was writing down quickly the target is 2%. $1 billion is within that 2%. So 2% of $62 billion is roughly $1.2 billion. And we want to make sure that we don't get below a billion. So when we have these target asset allocations, when I say 2% for cash or 38% for public equity, we also create a band. The Board of Trustees has created a band around that to create opportunity and flexibility for management within, because, for example, we don't necessarily want to have what we call hard rebalancing. We don't want to be forced to sell assets because we can only hold 38%. We want to be prudent and selective and have that as a financial opportunistic decision. So the trustees have given us bands within which the target asset allocation can float. If I might follow up, and if it's spoken to later, I can just wait. But the governor 2 years ago, I believe, reduced the dividend, and the legislature brought forward a budget that had a reduction of a dividend in it for the last 2 years. But statutory.
statutorily, the permanent fund board would have been required to pay, at least according to the rules that you're working under, two dividends at the full level, even though that's not what was appropriated. So is that cash still being invested, or is that held as liquid assets in cash? How have you dealt with that challenge? And again, if you've dealt with it in here already, or we're going to hear about it, I can wait.
No, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer that question because they don't address that directly. But in 2016, we were building up that roughly one and a half billion dollar cash transfer over the roughly one billion dollars in cash we were holding. When the governor took the action that he did, we immediately took the difference and deployed it in all of back into the asset classes out of cash. So that money stayed with the permanent fund and stayed invested then after that decision was made. It wasn't sent somewhere else. And again, if it's addressed later, we brought this up yesterday when Commissioner Fisher was at the microphone as well as OMB Director Pitney. There was an article that was printed in the Juneau Empire that was distributed to Senate Finance Committee members, and there was allegation, I think is too heavy. There was an assertion that the legislature's instability or because we haven't set up rules for the permanent fund board that it's costing Alaskans money because the board doesn't know what is going to be the draw, and so you're having to make a bandwidth variation for some surprise that might happen in the future. And I don't know if you can speak to that now, if you want to speak to it later and just think about it as we go through this, but that's why I asked the prompted question of if are you holding $1.2 billion that had statutorily been scheduled for permanent fund distribution, are you holding that in liquid assets or... No,
your comments, please.
Madam Chair, I think it's a fair question to ask, and I think that we plan for a cash draw that was based in statutes in the past and have pointed towards that. In this year in particular, in February, there was a board meeting. There was discussions about liquidity. The Board of Trustees gave direction to staff to work on a program for specifically to manage liquidity to a more effective return. But the point is that as I said, when you're having to trim back positions because the market is going up, the normal course of business is to deploy that into the other asset classes. In this instance, we started letting it stay in the form of cash and invested it in 90-day T-bills because all the debate, Senate Bill 26 passed in March. The House passed a version of Senate Bill 26 in April. Both those bills had a much higher draw than the dividend calculation draw. So rather than maybe $1.5 billion, it was going to be closer to $2.5 billion draw. And so we were pointing towards that number in holding the cash positions. I think it's important to note that from my professional opinion, what was prudent was not to be putting that money back into the stock market or tying it up into an illiquid class like private equity or real estate, but rather let's hold it on as cash because there's this movement, momentum in this direction after 2 years of, this is the third year of this debate, and upon passage of the budget in June, where the official final draw was $730 million, we immediately started pushing out the difference back into those asset classes, and it took us about 6 weeks to get that done, to get the balance put back out. But I think it's important. There's an opportunity there And if Senate Bill 26 had passed, I'd be sitting here today telling you, you will have on January 15th, its special session, you will have $2.5 billion based on the calculation that was passed that would be the draw amount. Ms. Rodell, and certainly this is not under fire by any means. This is trying to understand, and that's why we have you here today. So I appreciate that explanation. And I can't imagine at the Permanent Fund Board with somebody taking an oath to do the best that we can to earn money for the people of Alaska that being placed in that position. So I appreciate that answer. Does anyone else have questions from finance on this issue? Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Rodell, under an environment assuming SB 26 passes, and we're talking fiscal year 2020, let's say, how would the permanent fund's behavior be then to prepare for that $2.5 billion draw? Through the chair, Senator Von Himoff, if that were in place, we would be in discussions starting in January with the Department of Revenue and Treasury's Division's cash management about what the need for the transfers would be. Do they need it all on July 1st? Do they need two-thirds of it on July 1st and one-third of it on October 1st? Or do they want it quarterly throughout the fiscal year? They know much better through the cash management program about the timing and what their other resources are for managing cash. And then we would start pointing our liquidity balances, our cash balances, to those agreed-upon dates over the year. So it would allow us to maybe buy six-month Treasury bonds or to do something slightly different, longer duration, if Treasury Division told us they weren't going to need the cash on July 1st, but rather need it on October 1st. Unfortunately, we weren't able to have those discussions this year because we didn't even know. And when it comes to the dividend, that has always been, we always wire that money over the 1st of September. And then Treasury has it for a month before they deploy dividends. So that is a practice that has been in place for 30-plus years. Senator Von Imhoff. So thank you. So is it fair to assume then that it would be easier for the permanent fund to manage their assets if there was a stable mechanism in place, something along a POMV that you could look back at your market value for 5 years and do a predictable to the best of your ability, along with the conversations with the Department of Revenue about managing the cash that way over a period of time, a lengthy period of time, versus no such plan and a cash withdrawal at the time of the budget is passed for whatever amount that the budget happens to be that year. How would you compare the two scenarios?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, obviously the first one by a landslide. The second one is just, it's so difficult because even Treasury can't plan in that because they manage cash based on when they're going to get the other revenues that the state is entitled to. And so they try to plan that accordingly. And that's why I think knowing exactly what the draw amount is from the state can help them then plan out their cash management because then the volatility of the receipts in the other revenues can be managed more effectively as well. And so the Treasury Division couldn't even engage in that because they had no idea how much was going to come, if any, from the permanent fund. So it was a non-starter. So to have a plan in place where cash can be managed effectively, investments can be managed much more effectively, and that idea that you as a legislative body also know exactly how much revenue, at least a portion of it, and not relying on a forecast, I think gives a lot of stability to both sides, both the revenue and the expenditure side of the equation. Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You spoke, I don't know, 10 minutes ago. You said, and it goes on with this conversation that we're having right here. The sooner you know, the sooner you can maximize your opportunity cost. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, minimize opportunity cost, maximize return.
Profit,
yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Majewski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can hold my question until we get to page 10. I just had questions about the cash and temporary investments position, and I think the T-bill answer is in that, but I can wait, Madam Chair, if you'd like.
Certainly. Ms. Rodell, yesterday's conversation on this particular topic revolved around the Department of Revenue using the $2 billion that is sitting in the Constitutional Budget Reserve as a bridge for the payments coming in over time that are due to the state of Alaska that don't all arrive on July 1st at the start of our fiscal year. And so I posed the question to Commissioner Fisher asking if we're using the Constitutional Budget Reserve, which by statute, if you need it within 5 years, should be in a liquid form and easily accessible. So we're anticipating lower returns, which is why last year we asked the House to consider that when they inserted the capital budget into the operating budget and then proposed drawing a huge amount of money at one time from the permanent fund, the earnings reserve account. And that was noted in the article, too. And so what I wanted to know is, and I believe Senator von Imhoff was talking about it, too, is when we're looking at strategies both at the Department of Revenue and over at the Permanent Fund Board, we hope that there's continuity, that there is $2 billion at least currently being used as bridge money. And so the Permanent Fund should have ample opportunity, 6 to 9 months, to be able to respond to whatever policy the legislature would put forward. And so I just wonder whether that communication is happening, as Senator von Imhoff was referencing, as far as a plan goes for cash management, especially now as we're moving forward. And it is very contentious. I mean, the population of Alaska is frustrated with the legislature. The House is frustrated with the Senate. The Senate is frustrated with the House. And the administration, I'm sure, would just like to be able to have an answer. So from the Finance Committee perspective, I think that we all agree that we would like a plan in place in case we reach impasse, and so that we don't have bad decisions being made by the Permanent Fund Board trying to anticipate a extreme move from the legislature, not in consideration of the value both of the corpus and the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve Account, because at least this body held the line when the I'll just call it the Hail Mary pass to try to get out of session. I'm not trying to raid it or anything else. It was a move, but the move didn't happen. We said our piece, they said theirs, and we came to an agreement that that wasn't the best route forward for the people of Alaska. And so reasonable people are trying to pull this together.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. And those conversations do continue on. I think taking a step back to earlier in my presentation, right now, because the earnings reserve account isn't being used for anything other than dividends, it maintains the same exact asset allocation as the fund. And I think what you're pointing to about whether or not the Constitutional Budget Reserve sort of bridges over the course of that fiscal year, the reality is that whether it's $2.5 billion, $3 billion of draw, maybe it's not in 90-day T-bills, but it's also no longer in private equity. And so there will be a use of that fund and a recognition that that money is earning something different than both the fund and the Constitutional Budget Reserve while it's in that state of transfer, I'll call it. Thank you. And
The co-chairman and I have had conversations around lost opportunity for the state, and it's frustrating, I'll just say, from my position, and I'll let my co-chairman speak for himself, that we've lost 3 years of opportunity. The Senate passed a bill that would have created a framework, and we've done it multiple times, but because we cannot get agreement around the framework, we are losing opportunities, and I would say that we don't have an opportunity this year. We're projecting a $2.5 billion shortfall with a constitutional budget reserve that may or may not have that much money in it, and you cannot draw it to zero. And so we have to look at the earnings reserve account in the next cycle. I don't see another way around it. Some may say from particular areas around the state that we should cut a billion or $2 billion out of the budget. It sounds good in practice. If there were $2 billion hanging low that we could do that too, maybe somebody would try it. But most things that we do have statutory substance and foundation that require those payments to be made, or you have to change policy. And the Senate has been putting forward policy, so I'm interested in what the board will do given that circumstance. I just don't see another place to go. I can only tell you that from Senator McCann's perspective, because there is not statutory authority that is resting in Senator McKinnon. So, Madam Chair, the board is very interested in what happens and would very much like to see a structured plan put in place. It has now become a topic of conversation at every single board meeting as to what's happening, where are we, and what is the role to the Board of Trustees in this debate, recognizing that we have a very simple mission, which is fiduciaries of this fund to invest in perpetuity. This is probably as good a time as any to get back to Senator Von Himhoff's earlier question about PLMV and talk a little bit about the differences between 2003 and 2017. In 2003, the Board of Trustees worked very hard and passed a resolution that is still active today, which would roll and get rid of the earnings reserve account. This would be done through constitutional amendment so that the language you saw of income-producing investments, the income of which shall go to the general fund, would be changed to the PLMV language, which is income-producing investments of which the market value 5% would flow annually to the general fund. As I said, this is a constitutional amendment, and the legislature, the administration, the state would receive that 5% off the PLMV. The statutory framework that is contemplated by SB 26 or that has been discussed in other iterations is to not have a constitutional amendment, but rather use the concept of a draw, of a calculation of the total market value of all the assets attributable to the permanent fund. And that draw, though, can only come out of the earnings reserve account. So long as there's realized gains moving into the earnings reserve account and the earnings reserve account has a balance, you could continue to withdraw at a set percentage rate. I think that the value of doing a percentage versus a set dollar amount is that percentage then is allowed to float with changes in the market value. So if the market value goes down considerably, your 5% is going to go down concomitantly, and the permanent fund is not stuck in a box of suddenly having to sell a bunch of assets to generate $3 billion because the value has declined, and so that's not there. You would just get your 5%. And that's probably the biggest difference between the two is that if you did that 5% and the earnings reserve account got smaller and smaller,
Eventually, if 5% is something more than what's in the earnings reserve account, you're only entitled to have what's in the earnings reserve account. Thank you for those comments. We have been joined by Senator Dunleavy. Welcome to Senate Finance. We are on slide 8. Ms. Riddell, please continue.
We've covered slide 8, so I'm going to move on to slide 9, which is to give a sense of the magnitude of the unrealized gains that are in the permanent fund. And the reason I point this out is I get questions about what is in the principal of the fund. $39.9 billion is what is there in perpetuity. This is the nominal dollar amount of mineral royalties, mining, you know, the royalty revenue that the fund is entitled to under the Constitution, along with inflation-proofing deposits and other deposits. This amount only changes with additional deposits into the principal of the fund. So there is no inflation adjustment to this number, which that's why we have the inflation-proofing statute, is to make sure that what $39.9 billion buys today buys the same thing 10 years from now at 10-year from now prices. The $8.2 billion is the unrealized gain. As soon as any of that amount is realized, it will go to the earnings reserve account. It will not stay in the principal. The earnings reserve account has $10.4 billion invested with an unrealized gain attached to it of $2.3 billion. Moving on to slide 10, and my chief financial officer loves that I included financial statements. Others sort of scratched their head and said, I can't believe you're including financial statements. I'm including the two major financial statements, our balance sheet, and then on the next slide, I have our statement of revenues, expenditures, and changes in fund balance, because there's a lot of, I think, really good information that can be found in financial statements, and we post our financial statements monthly, so we have a tremendous amount of transparency into the activity of the fund that any Alaskan can find by looking at the financial statements. So these are the financial statements for the first quarter of fiscal year 18 as compared to fiscal year 17. And you'll see that assets continue to grow. We went from a total assets of just over $60.5 billion, and in 3 months, it was up over $62.3 billion. And you can see that these assets are found in cash along with all the other types of investments that we hold, marketable debt securities, real estate, absolute return, also known as hedge funds, private equity, public equity, et cetera. In the liabilities, you'll see an accounts payable of $884 million. This is primarily securities that haven't settled yet. So the trades have been entered into, but on June 30th, they hadn't, or September 30th, they hadn't settled. So they book as a liability on the financial statement, which explains why we have $1.8 billion in cash, because we're going to need $800 million to settle this accounts payable in the next few days. The fund balances, you'll see the non-spendables. So this is the permanent fund principal of that $39 billion, the unrealized gain of $8.2 billion. We carry in conversations with the auditors, we continue to carry the liability or the commitment for inflation proofing. If you remember, the dividend appropriation moved out of fiscal years. So on the timing, so it went from, to use accounting terms, it went from an accrual basis to a cash basis. But if you remember, we used to calculate the dividend based on the 5 years of performance, including the current fiscal year that we were in. And the way the statute read is it was as of June 30th, and so on June 30th, we would have a calculated liability for the dividend.
And then in 2016, when you passed the budget, you moved the liability out of that into the fiscal year in which the dividend was actually paid. The dividend is paid in October, so it was moved, shifted from June 30th to a July 1 liability. And because this is June 30th and September 30th, you don't see the dividend because it happened during this 3 months, not on these particular two dates. So I want to assure people the dividend was paid, and it did come out of the fund. You just don't see it on the fund balance. Senator Machinsky, did you have a question on slide 10?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. So two questions. First of all, the realized earnings and the unrealized appreciation on invested assets, that is your earnings reserve balance. So if we look at September 30, 2017, that $12.7 billion is earnings reserve by definition. Is that correct?
That is correct, through the chair.
And thank you, Madam Chair. So you made it clear earlier that however something is structured, whether or not it involves a dividend, I know I personally and my team on finance, our team on finance, would not, you know, ever endanger the principal of the fund, the corpus of the fund. So you're saying by law, whatever structure is adopted going forward, there's no way for that to interfere with the balance of the corpus. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Machinsky, if I understand your question, you are correct. There's no way to interfere with the corpus of the fund because that is constitutionally protected.
So Madam Chair, my final question, does that mean, so I asked that question earlier, what if you had to consolidate on an actual loss in the corpus with an appropriation from the earnings reserve? That's the only way that you could potentially impact the value of the corpus, is if you were looking for an appropriation to make up for a loss. Is that correct? A loss in the corpus.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Okay. So there is potential effect, and that's something that we would have to have some rules around to ensure that we didn't take it close enough where that shift couldn't occur to keep the corpus whole.
That, through the chair, from our perspective, that would be prudent.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Machinsky. Other questions from senators? Please continue. Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving on to slide 11, this is the statement of revenues, expenditures, and changes. And so this is the activity that leads to the increase in the earnings reserve account and the principal, unrealized gain and principal. And this is where you're going to see the permanent fund dividend. If you look on the right-hand side, transfers out of $716.3 million. We fund the dividend in two payments, one in August, one in September. And so this is the bulk of the payment that goes out for dividends in September, and I included this because on the balance sheet you couldn't see the dividend, and so I wanted to make sure that within this slide deck you could see that there was activity. If you look on the revenue side, for example, all of that interest, dividends, real estate, those monies coming in, that 3 months of $326 million, that's all money that's flowing directly to the earnings reserve account. Okay, that's your regularized sort of income. And then we keep a running calculation of statutory net income. So we back out the unrealized gains. We add the unrealized losses to make those adjustments to accounting rules net income to the statutory definition. Senator Bishop.
Just a curiosity more than anything on that. On the two-payment method, is that more of a true-up to catch at the end of the day on the last payment, just to catch some eligible people that maybe weren't eligible that now become eligible, or why is the two-step payment?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, actually the first payment is to help pay for the because we pay for the operations. Part of the dividend, I mean, part of the transfer amount goes to pay for the permanent fund dividend division's budget. And if you remember, Department of Corrections gets some of that as well. So it's to help fund the operations of state government that uses that money, and then the bulk of the dividend. And they carry a balance as well. Permanent fund dividend division carries a balance both for what we call sort of unclaimed permanent fund dividends, because remember, they do an estimation, so there can be last-minute eligibility. If you remember, through the dividend division, if you're between the ages of 18 and 21 and your parents didn't apply for a dividend and you're entitled to one, you can come in. So there's a lot of but there's cushion built in for things like that. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did the state pay for on the permanent fund any amount to defend the lawsuit? And if not, would that be considered eligible?
Senator Hoffman, I believe you're referring to the lawsuit for the Supreme Court on the appropriation. And I remember, I'm going to have to get back to you on that because I distinctly remember having a conversation with Department of Law about what our portion should be, but I don't recall what, if any, we ultimately ended up paying. I need to come back and check on that for you. I'm sorry. Mr. Co-Chairman, we'll move that to make sure that we have that in our follow-up so that the committee received that information. Thank you, Madam Chair. So now that you have a very good understanding, hopefully, of all the assets that we are that are under management of the corporation, I thought it would be helpful to move into how do we actually invest and manage this money. So we start with the Board of Trustees, and as the fiduciaries, the trustees have a duty to Alaskans in assuring that the fund is managed and invested in a manner consistent with the legislative findings that are in our organizing statutes, which are found in 3713.020. The permanent fund should provide a means of conserving revenue for mineral resources to benefit all generations. And I'm on slide 13 for those following along online. Secondly, the permanent fund's goal should be to first maintain safety of principal while maximizing total return. And finally, the legislative finding that the fund should be used as a savings device managed to allow the maximum use of disposable income from the fund for those purposes designated by law. This is still the foundational statutes under which we operate and invest and manage the assets under our responsibility. How do those responsibilities get divided up? Well, the Board of Trustees, as fiduciaries of the fund, have the full authority to make the investment decisions. On slide 14, they make those investment decisions. They delegate some of that authority down to me, and importantly, they approve the target asset allocation, and they adopt an investment policy. As Chief Executive Officer, my responsibility is to assure that the strategies adopted by the Board are successfully implemented. The Chief Investment Officer is then responsible for making those strategical and tactical allocations to allow the fund to grow in value. And finally, he works with each of the portfolio managers that are responsible for the investment and performance of each asset class. Do you have a question, Senator Hoffman?
Do you have a list of the current board members and their terms, and how often does the board meet?
I can give it to you verbally, and then I can follow up, Madam Chair, with a note, so you have it written to you. The board is comprised of six trustees. Four are members of the public, which must have experience in business or finance, and two are members of the governor's cabinet. One must be the commissioner of revenue, and the other is a cabinet member the governor is choosing. The four public member terms expire, they're four-year terms that expire annually. So each year, a trustee's four-year term expires. The current four members of the public are Bill Moran, board chair. His term, four-year term, expires June 30th, 2018. Carl Brady, vice chair, his term expires June 30th, 2020.
Sounds like she's
Larry working. Cash, his term expired June 30th, 2017, and he continues to serve until he's either renamed or a replacement has been named. And the fourth member is Marty Rutherford, and her term expires June 30th, 2020. Carl's term expires June 30, 2019. The current Commissioner of Revenue, Sheldon Fisher, and then the governor recently replaced Commissioner Fisher's seat on the board when he served as Commissioner of Administration with Commissioner Andy Mack. So those are our six members. Oh, I'm sorry, through the chair. The board meets four times a year, and it's a full two-day meeting every quarter. The next board meeting will be here in Anchorage, December 12th and 13th. Thank you, Ms. Rodell. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Okay, moving on to slide 15. This is the target allocation that has been approved by the Board of Trustees. You'll see that it's a very diversified portfolio allocation mix. It's designed to have a mix of risk and reward. It's designed for a longer-term investment horizon of 10 years and plus, and it also balances the potential needs for liquidity with non-liquidity. About 60% of the assets under management would be considered liquid assets, and about 40% are illiquid. So moving on to the largest asset class that we have is public equities. It probably doesn't come as a surprise. At the end of the fiscal year, we had approximately $26.1 billion in public equities.
Slide. Do you have a...
Senator Hoffman.
Do you have a breakdown of how much is invested internationally and outside the United States?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I do not, but I can get that for you.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman, I was thinking that same question. What are the activities that are happening around the globe? It would be nice to know how we're balanced in that realm also.
Madam Chair, and I do have some of that information. I just don't have it in a nice format where it's easy to say we have, you know, $30 billion in the U.S., $30 billion in non-U.S. So, but there is some color on that in a later slide. When we look at slide 16, you'll see we have $26.1 billion in public equities. This is in international equities. This is in global equities. As a reminder, global equities are funds or equities that have both U.S. and outside the U.S. exposure, whereas international is truly non-U.S. as well as domestic equities. One of the things I wanted to do with this is to give you a sense of how many people within the corporation are responsible for this asset class, what that management is, and what the holdings are, and what that cost is out of our for budgetary purposes. So there's a director of public equities, and he oversees currently an internal team of two, and he's overseeing 28 external managers as well. He meets with those external managers quarterly. When you look at the APFC operating budget of $2.9 million, we had a couple of different conversations about how to allocate this out, because as you can imagine, if I said 40% of our budget is 40% of public equities, isn't really a true representation of how work is actually done, because private equity is much more labor intensive than public equities. So what we did is we did this by headcount. So there's 20 investors. There's three associated with public equities. So 3/20 of the operating budget comes to $2.9 million. So they're getting a slice of my expenses, a slice of finance, a slice of IT. I'm sure there's probably other methodologies, but I want you to understand sort of how we came up with these numbers. And we pay external fees of $60.7 million, and then we paid an additional $3.7 million net through performance incentives on those external managers in their contracts before they remit value back to us.
Senator Machicki, can you still hear us? We're starting to get some construction noise up here. We're trying to diminish that now, but
I can, Madam Chair.
Okay, I just want to make sure that the public can hear. Thank you.
Thank you.
Moving on to slide 17, fixed income plus is our second largest asset class. We had $11.7 billion invested. This is the asset class that we have managed internally for the longest period of time. We currently have a team of five, the director plus four. They lead that daily trading activity. The operating budget associated with that is approximately $4.8 million. They manage $7.7 billion internally and then externally manage $4 billion. The externally managed is in this asset allocation, we include things like REITs and listed infrastructure, as well as there's global high yield that we use external managers for. So there is some external management, but the bulk of the activity is done internally in Juno. On slide 18, we had $7 billion in private equity and special growth. The director of private equity oversees a team of two. Private equity is an interesting, very illiquid asset class. We do this through fund managers. We also do co-investments, so we invest alongside of a fund manager into a specific investment portfolio, and we make direct investments. We think that the combination of doing all three gives us the greatest access given the resources we have. Co-investments and direct investments are considerably lower in fee structures than fund managers. As I said, this is very illiquid, but this is an important asset class for us, and it is the largest of our net fee arrangements, but you can see what the fees are paid externally versus through a net of fee arrangement. Moving on to slide 19. Another illiquid asset class, infrastructure, private credit, and income opportunities. We had $3.2 billion. The director of private income is responsible for this. He has one person who works for him on this side of his portfolio. He is also responsible for the absolute return portfolio, the hedge fund portfolio. This is looking for illiquid income versus growth opportunities. So we're investing in things like alternative energy, transportation, water, toll roads, ports, things like that that generate regularized income. We also invest in private credit, which is mezzanine, so that middle subordinate level of debt. And to be uncorrelated with the market. So what we're trying to do with this portfolio is that if this big run-up we're seeing in the market suddenly turned off and went down, this portfolio would counter some of that and offset some of that loss. So this is a diversification strategy to hedge against that public equity portfolio. Again, we've been moving towards a much more fully direct investment on hedge funds and not going through what is called a fund-to-fund manager. So we don't use a fund to go out and find these hedge funds, but rather we're doing this directly. It removes that whole layer of fees that we would otherwise have to pay to be in this asset class. Senator Stevens.
I'm sorry, some of the terminology escapes me. Mezzanine lending on page 19, could you define what that is?
Sure. So I think probably most people through the chair, Senator Stevens, most people are familiar with senior lending. It means I make a loan. If people think about their mortgage, right? You pay on your mortgage, that's a debt that's lending the bank has, gets all of that revenue. Mezzanine lending happens if there's a series of revenues that come in. So when you think about how company cash flow can work, the first dollars that come in usually go to repay a senior loan. They get the first right on the revenues that come in. Mezzanine lending gets the second right. So if cash flows aren't sufficient to pay the senior debt, your mezzanine debt isn't going to get paid. If your cash flows are just sufficient to make that senior lend, they get paid, but you'll wait as the mezzanine lender. So you're taking that second position in the waterfall. And I apologize if I'm getting technical and trying to figure out as I go along how to simplify this. But why we're interested in investing, because that would be the next question, why do you want to take this? Because when we look at the potential loss versus the potential revenue that we can get off of that and what we're paying to buy that asset, it is worth the income, and you'll see it in the outcomes. It is worth the return because we get paid more often than not. And because it's considered higher risk, you get paid much higher returns than you would where senior debt is being lent at today. Senator Von Imhoff.
Just comment that I was confused at the beginning. I'm still confused, but at a much higher level. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Senator Von Imhoff.
When sometimes the mezzanine debt, if I can remember correctly, is the second person who gets paid, but because it's a higher risk, but you just get more money in the event that you get paid. So if there's a big loan, you have a couple different people. You have the bank, and then you might have the permanent fund all lending the money for this particular investment. The bank gets paid first, and if there's money left over, then the permanent fund gets the money. It's a very good tranche to be in, because if you get paid more often than not, that's where you're going to get these north of 6% returns. That's what they're seeing. And I don't know, kudos to you.
Gone off. My apologies, Madam Chair. I think we've gone over slide 20. So I will move on to slide 21, which is our real estate portfolio. As of June 30th, we had $5.6 billion invested in real estate. This has traditionally been what we call core real estate. Core real estate is real estate that has a history of income producing. It's not speculative. It's not in run-up rental. It can be, we have exposure to residential, multifamily residential, retail, industrial, and office buildings. The director of real estate has three additional team members, as well as a number of investment advisors. And we have started to expand this asset class outside the United States, primarily in the United Kingdom, Spain, and Portugal, and continue to look for opportunities outside the United States, given where current real estate valuations are. And then our final asset allocation is probably the one that always causes the most head scratching to happen. And this is what we call, this one we call asset allocation and risk. And we have $4.5 billion attached to this one. And the easiest way I can figure out to explain asset allocation and risk to you is that there are certain activities related to investing that affect the entire portfolio. They don't relate to just real estate or public equities. So in this case, this is where we're talking about where we manage liquidity and cash for the entire portfolio. So when private equity knows that they're going to need $100 million next week, and fixed income thinks that they're going to trade and have X amount, and public equities, it all comes together in this asset allocation bucket. This is also where we manage and have started a currency program because of our international and global exposure. We have exposure to over 50 foreign currencies, and we want to make sure that we manage that exposure appropriately. And then we also had started 2 years, or not 2 years ago, about 7 years ago, an external CIO program that was to mimic our total portfolio and help us learn other strategies. Asset allocation and risk are responsible for that program as well. Senator Bishop.
So are you buying and selling dollars?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, no. We are not buying and selling. So we're not buying and selling currencies. But what we're doing is we have hired a currency manager in London, a firm by the name of Adrian and Lee. And what they're doing is they're looking at our portfolio and where we have exposure to the euro, and they're running dollar currency futures for us. So it's an investment program.
Cordell, I had written it down on a previous asset allocation sheet. Are you purchasing gold or silver or minerals, mines, anything?
Madam Chair, no, we are not, and we tend to not buy any commodities directly. Some of our managers may be buying commodities, and so we have exposure that way, but we are not buying them directly. So what does all this activity generate? Fiscal year 2017 performance, it was a good year. And it's easy, I think, a lot of times to really focus on a one-year performance, 12.57% on slide 24. But we also invest for the long term. And so for us, what's more important in many ways is our longer-term performance. So are the strategies that we're putting in place today generally take at least 3 years to bear fruit? And so when we look at our three and five-year performance, and then we also have since inception, to give a sense of whether or not the strategies that the Board of Trustees have put in place in their target asset allocation is doing what we want it to do. The passive index benchmark is a passive performance measurement. It basically, if you think about it, if we had everything done by the computer and there's no active management or intervention, it's a 60% stock, 20% bond, 10% real estate, and 10% treasury inflation-proofing securities tips. That generated in fiscal year 17 income of 10.26%. So we beat that benchmark by roughly 2.3%. So that's the added value of the active management that both the corporation staff and the managers we hire and monitor added in value to the fund. You'll note over 3 years, that is even wider at 3.37 versus 6.18. 5 years, it's 7.1% versus 8.94%. We also have a performance benchmark. Each asset class has their own performance benchmarks that they get measured against. For example, U.S. domestic equities are measured against the Russell 3000 index. So we build a portfolio performance based on the appropriate percentages, pro rata percentages of those indices. That generated very close to the passive index benchmark, a return for fiscal year 17 of 10.25%. It did better than the passive at 4.47, but you can see the fund did even better at the 6.18. And since inception, that performance benchmark has done better than the corporation at 8.98%. And then we have the Board of Trustees total fund return objective, which is 5% plus CPI. So for fiscal year 17, that calculation was 6.63%. If you subtract 5% from that 6.63, that means inflation was roughly 1.63% for fiscal year 17. Senator Bishop, please.
And that's pretty close to trending what has historically been averaging for inflation over the last as many years.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, inflation has been consistently low. You can see for 3 years, the three-year calculation of inflation is 0.92%. Since inception, we've had inflation around 2 to 2.5%. So over a 35-year time period, that inflation has stood. So in the when I get to the Cowen forecast, they have an assumption of inflation being 2.25%, and you can see that's consistent with a 35-year history of the corporation managing the fund as to what inflation has been over that time period. So we think it's a reasonable inflation assumption. Moving on to slide 25. This is the individual asset class performance. In this, you can see what were the drivers of generating that $7 billion in additional new value over the course of fiscal year 17. Equities, by far. I will point out what's unusual for this slide is that normally you don't see international, global, and domestic all up this much over the same time period. Usually what you see is the U.S. doing really well, international maybe not so much, or vice versa. You usually see more of a differentiation between those two. But overall, all the asset classes did very, very well, with the exception of non-U.S. fixed income and TIPS. And that is consistent with the TIPS, especially, is consistent in a low inflation environment. You don't expect those to do well because they're expected to move up with inflation. So they're sort of a counter asset as well. Cash earned 0.48% for the fiscal year, and that's in line with the 90-day treasury bill rates that were occurring throughout the year. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Rodell, as you pointed out, equities performed quite well. Could you just talk to me about infrastructure, because it looks equally attractive as performing well. And could you dive into infrastructure a little bit and give us a little deeper dive on the types of infrastructure?
Through the chair, absolutely, Senator Bishop. Infrastructure, I think the best way to think about infrastructure is that it's contracted income. then it's a long-term contract where you have defined income that's going to come from it. And it is, they're very large structural assets. In, we find most of our opportunities, and we are overweighted to Europe on infrastructure, and that's because of the way Europe finances its infrastructure. In the United States, there are fewer opportunities for us to invest in infrastructure, and that has to do with both the regulatory environment. For example, if you think about utilities in this country, in this state of Alaska, rates are regulated. And so, and utilities are either cooperatives or they're municipal owned entities. In Europe, you don't find that. They're privately held. And so they have a different way to generate income and value. We own, in infrastructure, these assets can be anything. We have everything from a toll road in Spain to Gatwick Airport in London to terminal facilities at the Port of Long Beach in California to solar power throughout.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm an infrastructure guy. I just wanted to make sure we were talking the same language here.
Senator Von Amboss. Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you thought about a toll road in Ambler, Alaska, or perhaps a Port of Anchorage, Alaska?
Through the Chair, Senator Von Amboss, the Alaska statutes are very clear that the permanent fund should and can invest in Alaska when that investment returns are at least, if not better than what we could receive on investments outside of Alaska. So if the Ambler Road was tolled and actually generated better returns than what we would find on a toll road in Spain, we would look at that and potentially make that investment. To date, we have not found those opportunities. Staying on slide 25 for just one moment, I wanted to point out that that private credit line item, when we were talking about that private credit, 9.59% return, so that you can see that's why we're in that asset class. Moving on to slide 26, so past performance is never any indication of future performance. Callan each year prepares a capital markets forecast for all of its clients. They spend a lot of time on each asset category, and then they combine these asset categories into your target asset allocation to give you a 10-year expected a forecasted return, I should say. It's important to note that we will not earn this forecasted return each year, but rather sitting here looking back 10 years, what would we have earned over that 10-year time horizon? And the idea is that they're forecasting we will have earned in 2027, when we look back to 2017, we'll have earned 6.5%. You can see the drivers of that 6.5% by each individual asset category on the right, in that chart on the right. And I think one thing that's important is that this may feel counterintuitive with what you're seeing today in the market. It feels counterintuitive when we are up like we are, that we would earn a forecast return less than we were forecasting a year ago by 45 basis points. But the idea is that we have been in a bull or positive market for the last 8 years, and there is a universal sense that this level of growth is not sustainable for 10 years. It may be sustainable for this year, possibly even for the next 3 years. But when we're looking at a 10-year time horizon, it's not sustainable. And therefore, that level of growth has to be tempered. And that's why you see the forecast rates, because they're tempering those out years to a lower growth expectation. And that then combines into a 10-year forecast of 6.5%. For once, and this is very difficult for the revenue forecast, I can tell you in those conversations, we have a statutory return that is actually higher than the total return. And that has to do with what I spoke about earlier, which is that when you're in these high valuation or high market activity periods, and you are having to rebalance and you're realizing a lot of gains. We've seen the same thing happen in private equity. We're seeing a lot of distributions right now in private equity because valuations are high. That all flows into the earnings reserve account. So it's generating a higher return in that bucket for statutory net income. So with that, I open it up to questions. I included in the appendix our quarterly investment management fee report. We provide this to the board in every board meeting. It also goes to legislative budget and audit. And this is something that we have done with our net of fees since we started net of fee arrangements more than 10 years ago. And so I just wanted to make you aware, if you weren't aware, this is on our website, this is in our board packets, this is in the LBNA packets, and so that information is there. This is an area that is continually trying to improve its level of transparency, and so as we are the beneficiaries of that transparency, we turn that transparency over to you in this report. So you'll see over the years, if you went back 10 years and looked at the original first set of reports, they're much more transparent as we have better and better information to report to you. So with that, I open it up to any other questions you may have. Senator Machicki, do you have any questions?
No, just listening intently. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Von Impel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As someone... I think about the economic diversification as well as new investment in our state. And, you know, on one hand, tongue-in-cheek, hey, we've got an Amber Rose to sell you. How can, and I guess this is more of a rhetorical question for the commissioner as well as other commissioners in economic development, how can we make Alaska attractive? So you, and I'm assuming that others like you, would want to come in and invest in infrastructure in Alaska. We have the 8-star road on the North Slope. We have an Ambler Road. We have a Port of Alaska. We have many other needs. How, I guess that maybe a conversation we should have at some point is, what are the thresholds that you need cooperating with ADA and seeing where there can be synergies to invest in our state?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I think, you know, it's interesting that at the September board meeting, we had a panel of venture capital and had some of the premier funds that we, or venture capitalists that we invest with, come and talk about venture capital, and you talk about infrastructure, but I think the lessons they brought to that meeting and to the Board of Trustees correlate and lend themselves well to the discussion about infrastructure. And I think one of the aspects of it is risk and making sure that risk is truly compensated for. And I think that we have a tendency to undervalue just how risky projects can be, particularly in this state. Two,
competition is healthy and should be embraced. And it was an interesting conversation about how open San Francisco, the Bay Area, is to competition and why that is probably the number one area for venture capitalists and startups on a number of different fronts, not just technology, but in the healthcare space and other spaces. And it was the sense that even if I started, done a startup, I would welcome you to the table. I'll tell you the lessons I learned, the mistakes I made so that you can start up, because I firmly believe that you getting in and competing with me makes me that much better and that much more valued, and the pie only grows. I think we have a tendency to look at it as there's a limit to the pie and competition is not good. And I think in some ways we have to think back to what I said about risk. So as you debate investing and diversifying infrastructure, how do you create a culture of openness and competition that invites people to come and start these things up and do these things? And when you look at an Ambler Road, what are the risks and what can you do, what steps can you take to both fully compensate if you expect all the risks to be taken by the investor, or what risks you're willing to take off the table and thereby get a lower, and then offer a lower return on equity. Because all too often what we're seeing is a low return on equity with all the risks.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Senator
Stevens.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens, I'm sorry, my mic wasn't on.
Thank you. Could you talk a little bit more about Cowen's forecast? Is that, do I understand that this is a firm that we hired to look at Alaska specific? Is that right, or is this a more general?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, Cowen is a they're based in San Francisco. They are a general consultant to pension funds, public pension funds across the country. In fact, the Alaska Retirement Management Board also uses Cowen. The Permanent Fund has used Cowen for 25 plus years. We just did an RFP for this contract, and they were the selected consultant. They're selected by the Board of Trustees. The staff runs the procurement in connection with the subcommittee of the board, but they are they work for the board at the direction of the board. And this is something that they do generally, and then they give this out to all their clients. And as I said, when they calculate the 6.5% for us, they're taking that Board of Trustees target asset allocation, applying these individual projected rates in those percentages, and coming up with the overall total fund return. They have a lot of groups within that work on these individual asset classes. They renew this each year, and we expect to see their revised 2018 projections. The board will see them in May at the May board meeting in 2018. Thank you, Senator Stevens. Ms. Riddell, Senator Stevens asked a portion of my question, and that is that we're seeing a reduction in the asset allocation rate of return, and that it is going, we're going to see the same reduction over on the pension side of the house. I don't think it's fair to ask you to comment on that, though I know you're the former revenue commissioner for the state of Alaska, so I don't feel too bad about tossing it on the table. In general terms, that will mean that our unfunded liability will increase. Senator, just for those listening at home, the commissioner of revenue, Sheldon Fisher, is in the audience, and he is shaking his head yes. And so when we get back into session on that issue, that will be an important conversation for Senate Finance Committee. It will be conservative in the approach for the permanent fund that we use those numbers to layer
other side of the house, when we look at our liabilities, we will increase our unfunded liability, and that not only affects us as a state, but because Mendocino County rules will migrate out to communities as we see that higher unfunded liability. And so hence the questions yesterday, Commissioner Fisher, on the health allocation versus the actual pension side of the house and wanting to understand more. So, Ardell, I don't mean to get you in the crossfire of that. It's just that this was specifically what we were asking about yesterday, and that is the new assumed rate of return that's being projected. And I would anticipate that that will hold for the coming year with the activity that's happening on a bullish market. But we don't want to get too overly enthusiastic. Any further questions from a committee member? Seeing none, I would like to, with consultation from my co-chair earlier when I came into the meeting, we made the decision to postpone tomorrow's presentation. Mr. Teal is located in Juneau, and we hope to fly to Juneau shortly to take up the Senate Bill 54 that is being discussed in the House, and so we thought we could hear that particular presentation from our legislative finance people in Juneau and save that particular expense, since we anticipate going to Juneau next week and receiving Senate Bill 54 from,
yeah, I knew that.
From the House. And so we will notify you. We're following those committee meetings as your leadership team on this. We'll notice next week's hearings tomorrow. At least our best guess on those, we have been on notice for about 48 hours that Thursday was in flux and that we might see Thursday on the floor. My anticipation for that is a negative now as of today. That bill is still in discussion, I believe, in House Finance. So I think that right now it looks like they will carry those discussions through the weekend. So we'll postpone. We'll go to Mr. Teal and have that conversation. That will be available online. We are not taking public hearing at that particular presentation, but just wanted to let the public know that that is being postponed into next week, and we will publish that as soon as we have that fixed. But again, we are watching the House to try to make sure we are ready to receive House